Hello and welcome to episode number 35 of the Mostly Erlang podcast. Today we're going to be discussing writing a book on Erlang, or just writing a book on programming in general, I guess. And we have with us some of our regulars, all of whom happen, or semi-regulars, all of whom have written at least one book on Erlang, and some of our cases on other things as well. So we have Francesco.
Hi there, Francesco, founder of Erlang Solutions, technical director. I wrote Erlang Programming with Simon Thompson, and I'm currently writing Designing for Scalability with Erlang OTP with Steve Vinovsky.
And we have Fred Haber.
Hi, yep. So Fred here. I'm the author of Learn Use of Erlang for Great Good, and also working on Heroku's routing team.
And Simon St. Lawrence.
Hi there. I'm Simon. I'm a senior editor at O'Reilly Media. I wrote Introducing Erlang. I'm currently working on Introducing Elixir, and I've spent most of my career writing and editing books.
And he was also the editor of my first book on Erlang, of building web applications with Erlang, which I wrote, and I'm Zach. Before we start, we have a couple of announcements. We have some conferences coming up. Erlang User Conference is coming up in Stockholm, 9th and 10th of June, and Mostly Erlang is now officially a media sponsor. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I will be there. We'll be doing a live podcast, mm-hmm. and I'll also be talking of another talk. Francesco, obviously you're going to be there.
I might not be there. Oh, it's actually the first conference since 1994 I'll be missing. But my son will be born the last week in May. Still not sure.
Yeah, that's a good reason.
Yes.
We will miss you.
We don't want to sleep on the floor outside.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah, but I'm still hoping on making it over for a day, but it's still not sure.
Well, if we don't see you there, we will see you some other point.
Well, it's for a good reason.
Yeah, the call for proposals for Strange Loop has also gone out, which will be in September in St. Louis. And this year does not conflict with any Jewish holidays, so I'm actually considering sending a proposal in, so maybe I'll be there. There are other Erlang Factory Lights coming up. Vancouver will be next month, the 17th of May, exactly a month from when we record this, which probably means it'll have passed by the time I actually edit this, because I'm way behind. Are there any other Erlang Factories coming up?
I would love to do one with Simon St. Lauren in conjunction with Oscon in Portland this July. You know, there's a really strong Erlang program there, and Elixir as well. So we're getting some real Erlang talent, including Robert Werding, the co-inventor of Erlang. I think Jose Valin is making mm-hmm. it. You know, I'll be there. We've got Mark Sugiyama, who's giving a tutorial on Elixir. Garrett Smith is giving a tutorial in Erlang and speaking as well. So, you know, I think we've got the pool. So hopefully we'll be able to pull that one off, but it's still in the making.
Also, NDC Oslo is going to be the first week of June. Brian Hunter has been putting together a functional programming talk track that will hopefully include a lot of Erlang and some other really cool stuff. So that's worth going to if you can make it. Yeah, and we're also slowly planning August Erlang Factory Light in Israel for August. It'll be in Be'er Sheva this time, in conjunction with the University Ben Gurion University of the Negev, which is, well, in Be'er Sheva. But it's an easy train ride from Tel Aviv. You who've not been to Be'er Sheva. Yeah.
And Lambda Jam will be July 22nd to 23rd as well in Chicago.
Oh, no, that's June. I was going to say, I'm going to be passing through Chicago, but that's June.
Yeah, it's the wrong month. I've done that.
To and from my sister's wedding, but I'm only going to be in Chicago for a few hours at O'Hare. Okay, so we've sort of covered the announcements. On to the main topic, writing a book on Erlang. So first of all, why would you want to do something that silly as write a book? It's a lot of work.
Well, I tend to write books because I can't not write books. I don't ever do what I did. I wrote 10 in 3 years. That's not very smart. I mean, for me, I've slowed down since I started editing books. I probably write one book every 2 years instead of lots and lots. But I just keep finding myself encountering corners that need explanation. And, you know, I'm currently writing a book on woodworking, which is a completely different planet from Erlang. But when I first encountered Erlang, it was through editing your book and through reading Francesco's book. And going, there just has to be a way to get this to beginners. Like, I mean neophytes. I don't just mean programmers who are introducing themselves to Erlang. And so once I get that idea stuck in my head, then it's hard not to write. I do have one case where I'm holding off. I had the same idea for Haskell. I'm holding off. We'll see.
Well, I started my book on Erlang, I'd written the book on HTML5. I'd wanted to write a book with O'Reilly for many years. And I wrote the book on HTML5 programming. And then when I was done with it, I was mostly a PHP programmer in those days, or PHP and JavaScript. And I kind of wanted to escape that world because I don't really like PHP that much for reasons that aren't, you know, I think everybody here, you know, who's used it has experienced, but aren't really relevant. And I went looking around for a new language, and I looked at Scala and Haskell and maybe Clojure, and then sort of stumbled on it to Erlang. Realized it was sort of a good fit for the stuff I like to do, but then I couldn't quite figure out how to build a web service with it easily. So I called Simon and said, "What do you say we write a book on this?" And he went, "Good idea, do it." Francesco, how did you get started with either your first book or the one you're working on now?
So the first one, I think, you know, there was a need for, you know, Joe had just come out with his book, which was brilliant. What it did was kind of introduce people to why would you want to use Erlang. And you know, the way I usually describe Joe's book, it's a reflection of Joe's character, so a burst of enthusiasm, you know, trying to get people to start using Erlang. But what was missing was an in-depth book which went into the details of Erlang, how you think, how you reason, and you know, a very hands-on book, you know, which also would describe the constructs. And that's where, you know, I started writing. I approached O'Reilly and, you know, they were positive about it. And it didn't feel like I was writing a book. What I at that point taught Erlang for about a decade. So what I did instead of writing, I started teaching. But instead of speaking, I was just typing away. And when I'd finished it, so using the examples in the training material, when I'd finished a chapter, I then went back and, you know, started thinking back, you know, where did, you know, students who struggle, what sections did I have to explain well? I went back and I cleaned those up. And when I'd done that, you know, the next iteration was, okay, now that we've explained it to those who didn't get it the first time around, how did we keep the really bright students happy? So, you know, what was not in the training material, but what did I go through when teaching and explaining it on the whiteboard? And, you know, those became the side notes. And then the last iteration was, okay, what were all the hard questions that, you know, students asked? And those answers were all integrated in the text in some shape or form. And I think it was brilliant also working with Simon. So I gave the industrial view, so the hands-on practical view. And Simon Thompson did a brilliant job on the academic side, giving the academic view. And, you know, together we really had a winning team.
And what do you include? What's going to be in the second book? And I've noticed it's gone through several iterations of who the co-authors were.
Yeah, it's just really hard, you know, getting focus and, you know, getting people, you know, to commit time. And in the second book, the first book teaches you how to use Erlang properly. The follow-up book teaches you how to build distributed, massively scalable soft real-time systems with Erlang. So we start off by looking at OTP in depth. So not just explaining OTP, but explaining what's happening behind the scenes and all of the freebies you get. So just to give you an example, we've got probably 40 pages on generic servers, about 35, 40 pages on supervisors. And if you think of it, you know, supervisor is one callback function.
Yeah.
That's all you need to do. So what we do is, hey, what's happening behind the scenes with a supervisor? And then how should you actually think and reason when you're implementing your supervision trees? And yeah, there is very little such material out there today. So the, you know, kind of level of detail which we're looking at.
And Fred, we should now get to you. You sort of came at it a different way because you just started writing on the web. And then
I started it as a website. And I didn't have really the plan to have it published as a book. I knew it was possible because I based myself off Learning Haskell for Great Good, which ended up being published. But when I started it, I just got permission from the author to kind of hijack the concept. Then I put it on there. I had the first three chapters. Someone from No Starch contacted me, but then it became dead for like 1 year or 2 years before we got to talk again. So for the most time, it was only a huge website that I wanted to be for free. I wrote it for about 3 years, and the entire time, the motivation behind it changed all the time because when I first started, it was a part of saying, like, I want to learn the language correctly, and I want to make the resource available for other people and help grow the community and stuff like that. then when you move a bit ahead, it becomes something like, I want to have the best documentation available for that kind of stuff. And I want to do it because it helps me get jobs or something like that. And then when you're near the end of the entire thing and about getting published, it's just like, I want to be done so I can move on to something else.
Yeah, there is that phase at the end where you're just like, let me finish already.
Yeah.
And it's just like the finish line keeps receding into the distance.
As I always say, you don't open the champagne. You've not finished writing the book until you're holding the paper copy in your hand. You know, that's the lesson I learned in my first book, and I learned it the hard way. Don't book any vacations until you're holding the paper copy, because you'll end up writing and editing while on vacation.
And you think you're done, but you're not. In my case, I ended up doing the indexing the 2 weeks, I think, between or around Christmas and New Year's Eve, because it was getting published in January, finally, or something like that. And I ended up doing the indexing myself on it. You just do it in a huge, huge rush while I was also finishing my last session of university and everything. So it's never done until it's actually done.
And somehow you were kind enough to tech review introducing Erlang in that same period. Thank you.
I know. I was doing a crap load of stuff, and I'm doing like half of what I was doing, and I still don't know. I still think I don't have enough time to do it all, so. But yeah, around that time, I reviewed, I think, one or two Erlang books, was finishing university, working full-time, and then finishing up Learn Your Summer Erlang at the same time.
I think you may have done tech reviewed some of mine as well. I didn't know Francesco did.
I reviewed the Yaws one. I know I reviewed that
mine,
one,
yeah.
too.
I think you, in order to write a book, you have to suffer from what a friend of mine calls helium hand, which is that, you know, when something needs doing, you suddenly find your hand up in the air going, I'll do it, I'll do it. And you're sort of looking at your hand going, who told you to say that? I didn't. I didn't want to do that.
At some point, the busier you are, the better you become at juggling all these kinds of conflicting tasks. There's a breaking point where it's no longer possible, and you're just going to end up disappointing everyone you promised to spend time on. But after a while, you find that kind of cruising speed where the quote, if you want something done fast, give it to someone who's really busy right now.
Yeah,
well, that kind of holds true after a while. If you get into some kind of a good pacing for doing a lot of work, you end up getting used to it and that whatnot. What's more difficult, I think, is balancing all of the other stuff that you're no longer taking the time to do, which usually could have been just like resting or sleeping or exercising, and now it's gone.
Working around the house, you know, making sure the dishes stayed done and things like that.
Having said that, you know, I found O'Reilly to be absolutely brilliant and really supportive. I mean, they took on, you know, professional graphics designers to do the diagrams. They've got someone who will do the indexing for you. They've got, you know, copy editors. I mean, they've got a brilliant team set up. And once you start getting into the whole machinery, it's just sometimes it's actually hard to keep up at the rate at which they're churning out things. And you know, we've worked with two editors at O'Reilly as well. Both really, really professional, and you know, it's a pleasure to work with them.
Yeah, no, it was good for me.
We tried.
I've only worked with the people at No Starch Press, and they've always been fantastic. I ended up doing the indexing myself because I ended up wanting to see how it's done at the same point and going through the Chicago manual of style and all that kind of stuff. But generally, they've also been a fantastic crew. The big thing I think that people possibly don't realize when they're starting the project of writing a book or a tutorial is that you will be reading your own book maybe 10 times, which is a crap load of times to read the same book. And no matter what kind of technical book you're reading, I doubt it's good enough to be worth reading 10 times. So you're going to be fed up with reading your own stuff all the time.
Yeah. And you know, keep in mind, it's 400, 500, 600 pages.
Yeah, mine was a lot shorter.
Ended up being 600 pages, and I read it like 10 times in the year. That's way too much.
Conveniently, mine was much shorter at 200, but I cover much less than you all do. So
yeah, it's still a lot of reading.
Yes,
it's still a lot of reading. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of just fine tuning. So the next sort of question is: now that we've discussed the books that we have written and that you know we are sort of in the process of writing, you know, what other books? So first of all, I think we will all agree that there is still a market for more Erlang books out there. I hope nobody.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
So, Simon, do you have any particular books that sort of on your list of things you'd love to see a proposal for?
I think I'd actually like to see a proposal for something that when I first sent my book to Joe Armstrong, he was like, well, this is okay. This teaches people how to do the Erlang, but it doesn't teach them why. And his book does some of that. Francesco's book does some of that. I think Fred's book does it in lots of fun ways. But I spend my computing time outside of Erlang largely in an object-oriented world. And I have an incredibly difficult time explaining to them why I'm doing this strange functional stuff. On the bright side, I think Doug Crockford taught JavaScript programmers that the word functional is not a satanic invocation.
It's not?
No, it's not.
Wow.
But it's really, really difficult to get people who've, you know, trained from the beginning to think in terms of imperative programming, to think in terms of object trees and developing programs as sets of objects. And what we now call kind of the orthodox or classical model of object-oriented programming, which turns out to be a relatively recent imposition. Yeah, I keep thinking that there are a lot of people out there who are in pain because they're using the wrong tools, but I don't have something I can just hand them that, you know, gives them a roadmap out of that. I could tell Java programmers that they should really go look at Scala as kind of a first step or closure if they're feeling brave. I tell everyone that they should look at Erlang. But there's more of a story there than I can tell in an elevator pitch. So that's something I would love to have. We have a project in the works on the Erlang runtime system, which I'm hoping will have influence beyond Erlang. I'm hoping people can, you know, look at what makes Erlang tick and say, oh, wait, why don't my systems have that? Oh, okay. We've got a lot to fix, don't we? And I would really like to see... David Eisenberg did something based on my introducing book for Erlang, and now he's doing it for Elixir, called Etudes for Erlang, which is a set of exercises. And I love that. I've really been excited to watch meetups kind of spring up around it. But I'd also like to see some books that are kind of project books that walk through applications and how to build them in Erlang. I don't mean like our kind of our classic large-scale telecom stuff that the Erlang heartland is used to. I mean, you know, the kinds of projects that programmers more frequently encounter outside the Erlang world. They need there's like a translation step, some kind of a mind meld that people need to have before they can cross over easily. And I keep thinking that one way to do that would be through a set of projects that, you know, you see from start to finish. Some days I think it would be good to show a parallel in another language. Some days I think it would be a terrible idea to show a parallel in another language. So I don't know. I feel like we've really just scratched the surface. A lot of it is Erlang specific, but a lot of it is also just the, how do we get people to start thinking in terms of functions?
I think, yeah, as you say, I think, yeah, that is, I think we've talked about it many times on this podcast. It is the biggest hurdle. You know, start thinking functional, start thinking concurrent. And
yes.
You know, how do you get, because I think, you know, what worries me, for example, with the whole adoption around Elixir is that people will end up, you know, they'll, you know, see it as a great stepping stone, you know, coming from Ruby is going to be easy to learn and it's going to be, well, the syntax will help, you know, facilitate it. But what they'll end up doing is programming Ruby with Elixir, which completely beside the point.
There's a great tweet that I saw recently about you can teach a C programmer to tweet to program in any language and they'll write C programs in that language.
Yes.
So, you know, yes. It's part of me wants to get to people as early as possible. Like, I mean, I was deeply corrupted by AppleSoft Basic and have spent years recovering, but I keep wondering what would have happened if my introduction to programming had been some saner language.
There are universities that are starting to teach Erlang at various places. Ben Gurion University down in Be'er Sheva is teaching Erlang, which is one of the reasons we're doing the Erlang Factory Lite there. But, you know, I mean, part of it is, I mean, here in Israel, at least, Erlang is very hard to find. And, you know, part of it, it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. And, you know, you need the books.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see a book on how to use something like Rayak Core and how to build the big concurrent fault-tolerant systems that maybe some of Francesca's book will cover some of that. You know,
if there's a motivation to provide for writing a book, is that if you're an expert or very well used into writing part of a kind of system, if you're the first one to publish a book or even an online tutorial about it, you get to control part of the message about how people are going to use it if you're the main source they're going to use. So when I wrote Learn You Some Erlang, I paid extra care to go back into mailing list archives and ask people what's the best way to use that kind of expression and whatnot and how to construct that in a proper way. if you're the only, I was the only free online tutorial to that extent, going into that kind of depth, what I was showing had to be right, because it's much, much harder to get someone to unlearn something than getting them to learning it right the first time. And with the chapter on maps, that's a bit what I tried to do. Recently, I got the chapter on maps out on Learning Some Erlang, but I directly went about how you should be using maps and not just a dict the same way you would be using it in Ruby or Python or something like that. So someone who's looking for a motivation to write a book or something, you have a way to control the kind of message that's being sent out in the public.
I was going to say, we're going to have an episode on maps in the, I'm not sure when, but sometime in the next month or two, I hope, in my plan. So
yeah, and I'll be updating, introducing Erlang for that, and I also have to update introducing Elixir for it. So it was kind of fun. I came to Erlang very happy after chasing Rails and trying to keep up with it, that Erlang was relatively stable. But now there's maps, and it looks great, so I've got to do more.
Yeah, well, you know, relatively stable doesn't mean, you know, completely, relatively stable is good. Completely static
is dead.
Is dead, yes. Yeah. Maps seems like a good addition, and it seems like it was done slowly, but for good, you know, but for reasons of excessive care.
Right. I mean, they had a huge problem with records, and now that they're adding a new type, which is not there to replace records, by the way, it's there to replace dictionaries and trees and stuff like that. They had to be careful not to have a second kind of broken data type that just angers people a lot.
Yeah, I mean, records, well, they have their issues, but we'll talk about them on another episode, maybe.
Different podcast. So I have a question for people here. People listening don't necessarily know, but whenever you're writing a book, there are tools for the trade. So personally, for the entire time I wrote Learning Some Erlang, I was writing HTML directly in Vim. And when I went to publish it and work with the publishers, there came the time to work with the tool sets that everyone in the editing team can use, which in their case turned out to be OpenOffice stuff to be able to copy things differently and swapping PDFs around, and pictures had to be in EPS or vector format to be printed. So I'm wondering, what did the other authors in this podcast end up working with?
So for building web applications with Erlang, and also my book on HTML5, we use DocBook, and O'Reilly, there was a subversion server, and Simon and I just checked stuff in there. So that's what we did. For the new book, Testing Erlang, it's being written in ASCII doc, and it's on GitHub. So it will eventually be also on the internal O'Reilly Git server as soon as I get around to doing that.
We're in the middle of a shift. I mean, we're still using DocBook, but we're most of the stuff that I'm writing and editing these days is in ASCII doc, which then gets transformed to either DocBook or to HTML. We're slowly shifting everything over to HTML. CSS for paged media does what we need for the layout side. As far as tools, I use an infinite number of really confusingly different text editors, but I just seem to bounce between different places. And as long as it's text, I'm okay.
Yeah, so O'Reilly, I'm writing for O'Reilly, so using DocBook Oxygen Author right now, which I have to say was a great step forward compared to Word, which we used when we started writing the first book. And that was 2007, I think it was, yeah.
When I started the HTML5 book, the web apps book, we think we started by using either OpenOffice or Google Docs or something, and I got about 3 pages in and went, man, this is annoying, and switched to DocBook. So, you know, DocBook isn't perfect. It's XML. You know, it's XML. It's kind of wordy, but...
Yeah, the real nightmare we had was more with the revision control when using Word.
I'm sure that would have been a nightmare for me, but I bailed out of it long before we got to that nightmare.
Yeah.
And that was part of the problem we had with OpenOffice. So it has a way to be able to track changes, and they have their own templates. And it's mostly a tool that they were using because it works for everyone down the chain, from people doing the kind of design and setting the pictures and the page and stuff like that. But revision control was really, really painful, and it felt kind of weird that with no starch for that entire process, it was working by sending documents by emails and revisions everywhere and stuff like that.
Right. I mean, this is especially frustrating because for all of us programmers who spend our days with real version control systems, we're going, this is a solved problem.
Yeah. And what's funny about no starch is that before that, they used to be using LaTeX, but it turned out to be too much of a pain for people not involved with writing the book directly to handle. And they made the decision to switch to something different. I don't know if this is still what they're using. It's been over a year now. But yeah, they used to have something that was able to put into source control, and it just got rid of it.
You know, I mean, this is what I liked about DocBook. And they also had it set up such that if I committed with a certain string in the commit message, the server would build it into a PDF that, you know, looked like a book. And, you know, if I committed it with the appropriate string, it would do that. And then if I wait 5 minutes and do a checkout, I would have a PDF of the latest build of the book. And then I could, or of specific chapters. So that was kind of nice. And I could then just print out a chapter if I wanted to sit and edit it. And it would look like a book, you know, look like the final book and not like XML source code.
It makes proofreading a lot easier.
Yeah. So Simon is, and you can also do things like put XML, you know, put comments in it because it's just XML and you can just stick a comment in XML.
Mm-hmm.
Is O'Reilly looking to publish more Erlang books?
Yeah. I mean, I think I have at least three more in the works at least. I'd be happy to talk to folks about more possibilities. I'm also, and I guess this is sort of easier, sort of harder, I'm also co-chair of the Open Source Conference, which Francesca mentioned earlier has a lot of Erlang in it. And I'm looking for ways to tell open source stories specifically about functional programming beyond the conference. So I'm going to be trying to do something probably around the end of the year that's really focused on functional programming. Maybe an online conference, maybe some kinds of local events. I haven't figured that out yet. But I would love to hear from people on, you know, what they need. In particular, I'd love to find out what people need to kind of convince their employers and coworkers to take this stuff more immediately seriously. I keep looking at Erlang and I'm thinking that there are so many ways we could be using this to make problems that we're solving with other tools much more tractable. And so that's kind of the angle I'm most looking for right now. But there is, you know, so much to do in that I'm happy to talk about lots of different possibilities.
Yeah. I mean, it's the, you know, I feel like if you look at, I don't know, Ruby or Java, there are dozens and dozens of books on Ruby out there. How many of them are, I mean, I don't know how many of them are worthwhile, but I suspect a lot of them are if you're a Ruby guy.
Yeah.
But, including, I should point out, at least one or two by Simon. The Erlang community does not have that level of books. I mean, I listen to the Ruby Rogues podcast at least occasionally. And, you know, they talk about, you know, various books, Confident Ruby, you know, things, you know, sort of all sorts of just specific Ruby books on, you know, how to sort of up your Ruby game. And I would love to see maybe not direct equivalents in Erlang because I suspect the books that would be, you know, I suspect some of the works in Ruby would be really uninteresting or boring or whatever, or not applicable in Erlang. But, you know, that kind of book where, you know, we sort of just go on, talk about cool other cool parts of Erlang. I mean, I could see a short book on just using Etz, Dets, and Amnesia might work well.
Yeah, I mean, part of what fuels the Ruby book market is the number of people coming into Ruby and people who feel they have to level up.
Right.
I mean, we're way past the Rails gold rush when sort of everybody was coming in to kick the tires, and that fueled a huge number of books. But Java at this point, I mean, there are still a lot of Java books sold, obviously, because there are a lot of people using Java. There are a lot of people who are, you know, learning Java and CS courses, so they come out with this foundation in it. Ruby is a little harder. People come to it having had the foundation someplace else. So I think that sort of opens a space for a lot more takes on the language, a lot more tellings. The other thing that's kind of funny about Ruby in particular is that they really set out to include multiple paradigms in the language. Sometimes I get depressed about Scala having so many parts, and then I remember that Ruby has lots and lots of options similarly.
So does JavaScript.
Yeah. Yeah, Ruby and Scala both seem to have done it with a much more deliberate aim to kind of allow different styles and different experiments. Right. But then, you know, if you come into Ruby new from another language, you have to figure out what idiomatic Ruby looks like so that the other Ruby programmers will stop complaining about your code. I haven't seen quite those same dynamics in Erlang. I'm sure there are conversations where people are like, that's a really bad idea, don't use the language that way. But I'd love to see more of that kind of conversation popping up as people really do try to figure out, you know, what the options are and what the best options are.
Yeah, and you know, definitely. I mean, there's become over the last few years a lot of great tools around Erlang. I mean, I mentioned Ryuk Core earlier. There's Web Machine. There's Chicago Boss. There's Cowboy. Lots Rebar. Lots of other sort of tools. I mean, I could list for 20 minutes.
Yes. We should probably try to get some collaborative, book writing on where everyone writes a chapter about using Cowboy, using Rebar, using Relex, and using Percept2 and all these other tools, and get it published.
Yeah,
that's a possibility. Something that I think is a bit kind of different also is that when you're looking at languages like Ruby, Python, PHP, and whatnot, they all tend to have that kind of same basic mechanism where you want to show how to write the application. And usually you dump it into production and you say, okay, that's good. You don't always have that approach that you need to groom your application and maintain it and do the operations on it, which an Erlang system will require you to do all the time in many ways. There are ways to just ship it and forget about it. But I think most people who will write or come to Erlang in the first place will have had a problem either with scaling or the programming models they had. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they get started, it's already way more involved. And most of the books at this point are starting books and nothing that guides you past production and what to do about that.
Right. I mean, I think an Erlang DevOps book would be brilliant.
Yeah. How to build the entire time I've been at Heroku, I've been taking notes about stuff I've done in DevOps, and I'm kind of preparing a kind of little notebook about how to maintain Erlang Node and stuff like that. I want it to be under a 100-page notebook, which is still a very, very long notebook. That's a side project I have right now, along with Recon, to do the maintaining of Erlang nodes and stuff like that.
I agree in full. I mean, the way where we are channeling now all of our experiences in DevOps is through Wombat, which is a generic OEM tool for Erlang-based clusters. And that's where we're basically, that's how we are solving it, just by writing the software which will help you monitor, manage, and maintain Erlang-based clusters.
But I think also, the definitely, an Erlang for DevOps book, taking maybe with sections on Wombat and, integrating with Chef or Puppet or things like
that
would be a great project. I would like to see just some more books. I think, Francesco, your new book will cover some of this, and I think my testing Erlang book may as well. Just sort of more advanced topics in Erlang, sort of assume that, you already, the web apps with my web Erlang web book sort of was a little bit of this toe in this pool, but sort of can assume that when you pick up the book, you already know the language. You've read, Joe's book or your book or Fred's book, but now just want more advanced look into the language and the ecosystem. And I don't quite know what that would cover. I mean, like a book on Amnesia or Ryuk Core might be great. But, I'm sure there are other things that you could go in, detailed directions you could go that I haven't even thought of.
Yeah. And even at kind of a fairly basic level, I'm really looking forward to the Erlang Runtime System book, because I think it's going to help people in operations figure out what's going on better than is currently easy. It seems like with Erlang, there are a couple of different levels that really affect operations. One is the tool set that, we were just talking about covering. But the other is that the concurrency model means that you have to look at the entire application differently, and the kinds of errors that can happen are frequently unfamiliar to people who are, used to tracing their way through an application. So I'm hoping the runtime system will start to tell that story, but I think there are going to be a lot more options to explore.
The other thing is, we're talking about these books, these ideas for books. And, Fred's book was 600 pages. Francesco, your book was 600 pages, I forget. Some of these things could be, the DevOps notebook that Fred was talking about could be 100 pages, or even there's some of these topics and that could be a very useful 40-page ebook. How to something on scaling or, setting up Amnesia or whatever. Using Erlang with AWS, maybe. It might work out that, I don't know, but it might, that a 40 or 50-page ebook could cover that very well.
Yeah, I think at this point, a trend that I think we tend to see is that when there isn't a lot of documentation or books or anything, development happens to be very, very slow in terms of libraries and stuff like that, because not a lot of people have the time and initiative and desire to just dig into the source and figure stuff out. So Erlang releases have been terrible for a very, very long time. And I recall that when I started, Francesco published their chapter on it, and OTP in Action had their chapter published on it. I then had mine. And the more it goes, the more you see tools that try to make it easier and more usable, because people start to understand the existing mechanism better and then can provide layers of abstraction.
Right.
Okay. And for Erlang books, I think we're starting to move past the phase of we need starter books, because you've got Joe's two editions, you've got Francesco, you've got OTP in Action, you've got mine, you've got yours, you've got Simon's. And at that point, the space for beginner books is starting to be saturated. So I think this is the moment where people will be able to get a lot of information, and we'll be able to make assumptions about what the reader knows. You'll be able to say, like, we assume that you know Erlang, and if you don't, go read these things.
Right.
From now on, we're talking about how to build a web app with Erlang.
Right.
And from now on, we're talking about how to maintain a node you actually have deployed and that kind of stuff. And you need that kind of solid ground on which to build in terms of a community. And the more documentation you have, I think, the easier it becomes to see more and more books and more documentation and more libraries coming out of that.
You know, you also have chapters in 7 languages and 7 weeks on Erlang.
Right.
And then in 7 web frameworks and 7 weeks is a chapter on Web Machine.
I mean, differences, like we have the Handbook of Neuroevolution through Erlang. That is one example of an application-specific thing that uses Erlang. If you go in, let's say, Python, well, you have a bunch of them. You've got machine learning, you've got digging, you've got writing mail servers, you've got all kinds of stuff with Python. With Erlang, you've got learn Erlang itself and then do neuroevolution. Then you've got yours about do a web service. But you don't have that kind of, I want to build a kind of application with Erlang.
Right,
right.
Here's how you learn Erlang, then figure the rest out yourself.
Right. I mean, I built at one point, you know, it might be useful just to take, again, I keep coming back to Ryak Core because I just happen to like it. Take Ryak Core and say, you know, here's how to build 3 or 4 applications around Ryak Core. I mean, even if they're ones that Ryak already that Basho already provides, not because you necessarily want to build whatever it is, but just it's an exercise to show you how to build stuff. You know, I'm working on some material now for the testing, or like how to do TDD with QuickCheck, because I feel like that's I've done some of it. I'm actually using proper, not QuickCheck, but it's wonderful. It's a wonderful experience to do, but it definitely takes some mental remapping.
Yeah, no surprise about that. One question I hear a lot being on IRC is always, I want to learn Erlang. What's a good starter project? Mm. And it's kind of annoying to keep telling people do a chat server all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a few billionaires as a result of that.
Yes. Lightning doesn't strike in the same place that frequently. Part of what I would like to see is some stuff on Erlang that just sort of assumes concurrency and tries to do tasks that we think are normal rather than sort of spending all of the time on concurrency, showing, you know, things that seem simple in other languages can seem really strangely hard in Erlang. Things that are hard in other languages seem really easy in Erlang. I'd like to find ways to get past the things that seem easy in other languages are difficult in Erlang.
Right, you kind of want to show the other side of that coin. The things that are hard in Java are easy in Erlang.
Right.
You know,
but the things that throwing up an application that runs using a text-based interface is trivial in most languages and creatively complicated in Erlang. So.
Right. I mean, to be truthful, I can't remember the last time I've actually tried to write such an application myself.
No, but they're kind of fun to play with. I mean, what would it take to do Dwarf Fortress in Erlang? Never mind. But, you know.
I've never actually played Dwarf Fortress, so I have no clue.
To add to, you know, other, you know, books and areas where I think we really need quite a bit of, you know, we need someone to start taking the lead here, is in the area of design patterns.
Yes.
You know, I think we in the Erlang world have been really, really bad at describing design patterns. That's something I've come to the realization, you know, hanging out with the ACCA guys at TypeSafe, where, you know, they'll go in and they'll describe your promises, or they'll have your, you know, reactive extensions or your streams or whatnot. And these are, you know, your agent systems. And these are all things where in Erlang, you know, you can easily do them with 10, 15, 20 lines of code. So you've actually not gone in and, you know, no one's actually taken their time to go in and formalize them. But, you know, someone coming from the outside, and I think we had a great, at the Erlang factory in San Francisco, you know, we had Dave Thomas going in and saying, hey, you know, you guys don't have a promise, you know, promises. Well, you know, and Fred in the background, yes, we do. You know, it's called async RPC. Yeah, that needs to be formalized in some shape or form. And so, you know, and the Erlang Design Patterns, you know, book would be brilliant. So anyone listening and wanting, you know, to write one, let us know. I mean, it could even be done as an open source collaboration, which, you know, we could run on Erlang Central.
And so then something, you know, a bit get more like a cookbook in a way.
Yeah, a cookbook as well. You know, I think if you look at, you know, we've migrated, you know, the cookbook from TrapExit to Erlang Central. Now we just need, you know, a few hundred more recipes you know, to bring it into the 21st century, and then it's ready to publish.
Looking at my shelf, or not now, but certainly in the past, a number of books, you know, the Bash Cookbook, for example, is something that I frequently turn to on Safari when I need to figure out how to do something with my shell, or the SedNaw Cookbook. So, you know, if somebody wants to create the Erlang Cookbook.
I think, though, we're talking about something a little different. I think an Erlang Cookbook with common recipes for tasks would be good. Design Patterns is less about recipes and more about thinking through the problem.
Oh, yeah. Well, clearly those would be... I don't think those two would be the same book. I'm just saying that...
Oh, I'd like both. Yeah,
definitely. An Erlang Design Patterns book would be wonderful. And as well as an Erlang Cookbook where you have, you know, several hundred or however many it is, recipes for how to do cool, you know, useful things in Erlang that are, you know, useful. And that would be, I think, very powerful that if we start having it, you know, 2 years from now, a bunch of these books, you know, showing up in beta format, I think that would be great. And I think...
Have you seen what we've got on Erlang Central?
Not recently. I mean, I've looked, but not in the last month or two.
I'll post a link now.
All right. Well, look afterwards. You know, also the saying, you know, pointing out to anybody out there who, all right, some of these books you clearly do have to be an Erlang expert for, but for some of these books, you know, somebody who's learning, who has some programming experience, has some writing experience, and, you know, is willing to do the legwork, you don't necessarily have to be an Erlang expert when you start to write these books. I know when I started my book on Erlang, I was not an Erlang expert, and I think, Fred, you've said the same. Francesco, I suspect you're on the other side of that coin.
Yeah. I wanted to document everything I knew in case I got hit by a bus.
Well, please don't get hit by a bus, especially now that you're expecting a kid.
Yes.
But yeah, you plus just mentioned like you wanted to document something, and I think this is something the Erlang community still doesn't have. And that's probably a vicious circle because you start by reading the source, and people who are fine with reading the source are people who are going to be fine telling people to read the source all the time.
Yeah. Right.
So unless you have a few people who get fed up and start documenting their stuff, you're always going to have only people who want to read the source to figure things out. And you're never going to get better documentation and better books.
I mean, yeah,
and this is the kind of culture you have to get into the community that I'm going to document this thing about how to use it, about how to contribute, about how to do these things. And eventually, people who are there and care about good documentation will start joining the community and churning more of that for you.
I agree, Fred. I mean, the difference with me, I'd been teaching Erlang for for a long time, and so that's really what there's got to be a better way than flying me all over the world, you know, to spread and share my knowledge. And and the book, you know, Riley opened the doors and made this possible.
And also the fact that, you know, if you're looking for a way to put your become, you know, if you're learning Erlang, you're saying this is pretty neat. You know, for example, somebody who might be just starting out in Erlang. And you know, you hear this like the design patterns idea, for example. You think, you know, what are the patterns of this language? I know what they are in some other language, Ruby, Java, Python, pick your favorite. But I don't know what Erlang. You know, maybe find a few collaborators and sort of just go and learn. And as you're learning, write it down. And you know, people on the mailing list in IRC and us on the podcast and others will, you know, be happy to contribute. And that is certainly a way to become, you know, to sort of jump yourself up to level yourself up in the language. Because, you know, if you're going to write a book, you have to sort of, you're going to learn it. You're going to learn it really well. And your name's going to get out there. I mean, I know for myself, the way I got known in the Erlang community was I wrote a book on it. And I think, Fred, the same happened with you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, before you wrote Learn You Some Erlang.
Before I wrote that, I was writing PHP.
Yeah, me too, actually. Well, before I wrote my book.
But yeah, I mean, I got known because of the documentation. That's the basics of it.
And, you know, if you don't want to do it all yourself, find a collaborator. And I should point out, you know, it should be pointed out, even if you're not a native English speaker, don't let that stop you. Because clearly two of the four people on this call are not. So.
And it doesn't all have to be in English either.
Right. I mean, there are a few books on Erlang in other languages. Pavlo has one in German. What else is out there? I don't even know.
Spanish. Japanese. And these are original ones. And French.
I think there's one in Russian, too.
I know, you know, my book and Joe's book have been translated to Russian, to Korean, Chinese.
My book on HTML5 has been translated to Polish and Italian, but I don't think my Erlang book has.
I've been told of plans for mine to be in Japanese. They're almost done. I think they're picking covers right now. Chinese, I haven't heard about that one. I know we also have rights that have been given to a Russian company.
So, brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Nothing in French, even if it's my first language.
It feels weird holding a book you've written with characters you don't quite understand. But it's a great feeling.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I ever get a copy, Francesco, if I ever get a copy of the Italian version of my book, I'll ask you for help. Because
anytime.
Or if Polish, I'll ask Monica. But yeah. You know, I mean, I think the idea of writing open source like Fred did on his webpage or I'm doing on GitHub also, I mean, it's not necessarily the right choice for everybody, but I'm kind of enjoying it. It has some advantages. You get feedback earlier. You get some following earlier. And occasionally people even send you pull requests with spelling correct with, you know, proofreading in them. So that's kind of nice in that you can show it off before it's done.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the Designing for Scalability with Erlang OTP. We'll be releasing it as an early access, hopefully, well, in about a month's time. And so more or less when this podcast has come out, I'm really looking forward to starting getting the feedback, you know, from, you know, the wider community and wider set of users.
Do you know what animal is going to be on the cover yet?
Oh, yeah. They picked the ugliest possible one. Luckily, it wasn't a donkey or a snail, symbolizing the speed at which we're getting the book out. But I think it was a sole. So it's an ugly fish they've picked. So
on my book, I actually wanted like a bunch of animals to symbolize the concurrency. So I got a school of fish.
Okay,
that's the story. Oh yeah, you know, you have like it's like stingray or something on the cover of your book, or maybe it's a flounder.
Something I've noticed, or rather I haven't noticed in the discussion, is that in motivations and stuff about writing a book, nobody has mentioned money. Which I think is important to point out when you're trying to write a tech book is that you don't do it for the money.
Absolutely not.
I got a royalty check in the mail today I assume it's mostly the Erlang book because I don't think the other one's outsold its advance yet.
Is it enough to buy us coffee?
Yeah, it is. It is. But it's less than $100. I won't say exactly how much it is, but it's less than $100.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's still nice to get them because, you know, it's money, but...
Yeah. It's not free money. You have to work harder than what you get back from there direct money.
But it does open up a lot of doors.
It opens up doors.
Yeah. It's side benefits.
Yeah.
It gets you the money. Don't do it for the money. Really, do not do it for the money. I mean, I'm not saying don't cash the check when it shows up. Checks when they show up, but you know, do it because you enjoy writing. Do it because you enjoy explaining things. Do it because you think it's interesting. You know, you enjoy the process.
It's not necessarily worth the pain if you don't enjoy the act of writing the book itself.
Oh, completely.
No.
And, you know...
I say, you know, I don't know how, you know, everyone else... well, Simon's is probably the only exception here, but, you know, people say that, you know, writing a book is like having children. As soon as you've finished a book, you want to run off and, you know, write another one. And I know that's the way I felt when I'd finished my first Erlang book. I don't know if, you know, that's going to be the case with children when I get my first son, but we'll have to see on that. But it's I don't know, you know, Zach, I mean, you started writing right after, you started writing a new book soon after you'd you know, finished your first, your second one.
Right. Well, I mean, I started the building web applications with Erlang. I was still working on the HTML5 book, and then I actually started another book on JavaScript that kind of died. It was on using monads and JavaScript, but I just decided I wasn't a good enough writer. I didn't understand the subject monads well enough to pull it off, so it kind of died, and I don't think it would have been very good anyway. And then started this book soon after, and I had a few other ideas along the way that never went anywhere. So, you know, it'll get you employment. You know, it looks great on your resume when you're trying to get employment, or, you know, if you're a consultant trying to, if you're going into a sales pitch and you can hand somebody a copy of your book that you wrote on the subject that they're asking you to do, that looks great in a sales pitch. Because, you know, the other guy who's pitching for the same job, he doesn't have a book and you do. That may help. But yeah. the money is not...
Yeah. I basically reinvest the money from the tech books into my woodworking adventures. So basically, I just keep fueling new books with old books. It's a strange perpetual motion machine.
You know, but it's also the feeling that the best feeling I get when I, about my book or any of the books I've written, is when I get some random person on Twitter, you know, messaging me saying that they learned a lot from it or they enjoyed it. I assume you guys all get the same similar tweets from time to time.
I get it in person. I do a lot of conferences and travel a lot. And I almost, you know, people come up and, oh, great book. I almost find it embarrassing, you know, especially when they ask me to sign it. I'll never get used to that. If you want to embarrass me. Yeah,
I liked it at conferences. Yeah, at conferences, in my case, I often get the comment that, thanks for the book, I got my job because of it, which is extremely rewarding as a comment to receive.
Yes. I mean, because it's just nice to know that you've, you know, created value in the world, and that by paying the $25 or $50 or whatever it is to read your book, or even just reading the free online version, that, you know, somebody learned something that they found useful. I mean, I think that's incredibly rewarding.
Yeah. That you helped someone. Yeah.
I was thrilled at Erlang Factory to sit down at a table with somebody who looked kind of familiar. And finally, I figured out that I'd met him at one of the Erlang meetups in New York where they were working through etudes for Erlang. And His work wasn't actually Erlang. He just was so excited about the language that he'd come all the way to Erlang Factory as his one conference of the year. You get people excited, you get them all charged up, and they'll do great things.
It's all right. At Erlang Factory Light Tel Aviv, somebody asked me if I'd heard of the Mostly Erlang podcast.
Good. Perfect.
Yeah. No, that was actually a great conference. Andy, your colleague Andy Oram, who was, I believe, edited one of Francesco's books, or is editing.
Yes.
Happened to be in Israel that day, and so he showed up for about half the day, which was kind of a nice, you know, somebody who wouldn't have ordinarily come to a local conference in Tel Aviv, you know, turning up because, well, he was here on holiday with his wife, and he was able to convince her to let him take half a day to come hang out with geeks. Yeah, I mean, there are other things. I mean, people are doing Erlang in embedded stuff, you know, on this all the Raspberry Pis and stuff. There might be a potential for a cool book there. 20 projects with Erlang and a Raspberry Pi or Arduino. Yeah,
that's what I hope happens next for Erlang books, is that we move from learn Erlang books into do something cool with Erlang books.
Definitely.
Basically.
So Mike Williams, co-inventor of Erlang, was thinking of doing a book on home automation using Erlang.
Ooh.
Raspberry Pi.
That'd be fun. Yeah.
I would love to, you know, there are a bunch of things I'd love to automate in my home.
And also what we need as well is an Erlang for Dummies.
What I would like to see is Head First Erlang. Oh, I don't know if the Head First guys have put out a new book in a while.
They still do. We've talked about it. It would take the level of work that goes into a Head First book is terrifying. It would take a larger Erlang audience for that to make sense yet. But right. I think we'll get there.
I think your book and Fred's book sort of more or less fill that niche.
Fred's book definitely has the fun. So
yeah. The takeaway from this podcast is that, yeah, I think you did just hear. Well, that was a rooster, right, Simon?
Oh yes. Sorry,
that's okay. And you know, I think the takeaway from this podcast is that, The advanced.
That's a good takeaway.
Yeah, the amazing part of this podcast is that I have completely lost my train of thought. This train of thought now departing platform 9 3/4. Speaking of different books, but that there's a lot of potential for Erlang books, especially sort of the more advanced books or sort of the second level books, I guess we could call them, and that people who might think that they have a book in them, there are publishers who want to publish those books, or you could, and you can of course also publish them yourself as ebooks. But O'Reilly would be interested in publishing them. You said, right, Simon?
You were interested in talking, definitely. You know, I think that the Prags are also interested. No Starch is clearly interested. You know, there's a lot of opportunity.
Hey, Press and Pearson are interested as well. So
yeah, and if you want to go it yourself, you can even do self-publishing reasonably well these days. So there are lots of us who would, you know, love to talk to you and figure out how to make this much more exciting.
I mean, yeah. Contact us. We'll, you know, we get contacted all the time. We'll put you in contact with the editors looking for offers.
Yeah, and I even see somebody just tweeted about a Getting Functional with Erlang Lean Pub book. So it's clearly happening.
That's coming. Yeah, cool.
Getting Functional with Erlang. Ooh, yeah, I just saw that tweet. So we'll put that in the show notes as well. And, oh, I see. They've got sort of a notify me when this is published thing. What would you be willing to pay? So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of potential here. There's a lot of interesting things that we need, things that we need to cover to make Erlang jump to the next level. I think my book and the Neuroevolution book sort of started that, but my book's kind of basic on that, but I'm talking about the web book here. And Neuroevolution is interesting.
Way advanced.
Interesting, but way advanced and very specialized. I think the Testing Erlang book may also cover some of that space, but I mean, to be blunt, it's a huge space. You know, the home automation with Erlang would be a completely different book. You know, how do you build different kinds of systems with Erlang? I think all of those are books that we should have, and I'm sure there are a whole mess of other ones that none of us on this call have thought of, but that somebody else thinks would be interesting. So if you have any cool ideas, please, please start talking about them. With O'Reilly, with the Prags, with No Starch, and you know, any other, whatever other publisher you like, as well as on Twitter, on Erlang Central, on IRC, because I think that having those, you know, those second tier materials would be a big driver for convincing people that when they're going to build their business systems to look at Erlang more seriously. And I think that's something that, you know, it's obviously in all our interests who are recording this, that we're all kind of invested in Erlang as part of our careers. Why don't we get to the picks?
So write more books, yes.
Write more books, yes. So any...
I've got a pick which is, well, actually related to this subject. And it's a presentation Eric Merritt, Martin Logan, and Richard Carlson wrote soon after having written Erlang OTP in Action.
Right.
And you know, it's a presentation at the Erlang Factory in San Francisco. Don't quite remember the year. I think it must have probably been 2010, possibly 2011.
Okay. Do you remember the title of the talk?
Yeah, so it's, you know, writing a technical book.
Okay. Simon, do you have any good picks?
Sorry, I muted the roosters.
Muted the roosters.
Yeah, my pick is actually not an Erlang pick. It's something that's done with Java, Scala, and Clojure that I'd like to see somebody do on the Erlang side. It's Neil Ford talking at OSCON last year in an interview that I did with him, sort of talking about a path for people to take to get into functional programming. You know, obviously that's in the Java space specifically, but I would love to see us do more of this on the Erlang side.
Well, I was going to say, another interesting place would be, you know, another interesting top place to put a book would be bridging Java and Erlang, both in terms of programmers and in terms of code and stuff. Fred?
So in my case, the pick I have is actually a blog post I wrote a bit over a year ago, which is Don't Be a Jerk, Write Documentation, that I feel is appropriate here.
Mm.
I brought in the point about the culture of documentation, and those are basically the notes or the ideas I have in general about what documentation should be for a software project of some sort. And there are countless of how to write a technical book, how to get published tutorials. And I encourage people interested in writing books to look into these. But for people who just want to get, I don't know, the hang of writing a little bit to explain stuff technically, the opinions I have about how to write documentation might be helpful if we end up having the same kind of ideas about how to do things. So that's my pick for this week.
And let's see, I have two things. So I mean, there's a new series on Evolution on PBS called Your Inner Fish. I've seen the first episode. It's worth watching. Nothing whatsoever to do with programming, but it's kind of fun. In terms of programming, I've been playing a lot with Prolog. It's sort of been my pick a couple of weeks in a row now. So, and with testing. So QuickCheck is the other thing that I've been sort of QuickChecking proper. And we've done a couple of episodes on property-based testing, and we're going to have the Quivic guys on. We're working on details of scheduling at this point. So any last words from anybody? Francesco?
Nope.
All right.
It was great being on this. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, guys. I will get this online eventually, and I apologize to everybody out there for being rather slow with posting episodes, but it's been life. So, yeah. All right, guys. So
thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, yeah.
Bye-bye.